So let's just briefly go through what we did. So I had some potential. Let's say it looked like this. We were being somewhat schematic. The important part is that it's got this minimum and then some other place that we can go, which allows for a continuum of states. So if I call the position of the minimum x f, where the f, I think I actually didn't mention this before, has a meaning. It stands for false, because this is a vacuum, but it's in fact a false vacuum, because if I sat there, I wouldn't stay there forever in quantum mechanics. Yeah. So we do this trick of going to Euclidean time, and that allows us to identify a classical path that can connect in Euclidean time xf to the other side of the potential, which we'll call x star. And that trajectory was given by some function, we'll call it x bar. Okay, and this solution, x bar of tau, we called a bounce or an instanton, however you like. And we computed this decay width, which was given by this prefactor, which came from the zero mode. You remember the translationally invariant fluctuation, times h bar, times this ratio of functional determinants, which actually I'll talk about in a second to address the question we got yesterday, times e to the minus the Euclidean action of that classical path over h bar. And that was the formal answer. So remember, these determinants here are shorthand for solving this eigenvalue problem. So I have this set of solutions xn. I take negative x double dot n plus v double prime x bar xn, and then look for solutions to this eigenvalue problem. So find all the lambda n. And this determinant is just a product of 1 over the eigenvalues to the half power. Yeah. Okay. So this was all very formal. And I got a question yesterday about how do we know that this product of eigenvalues isn't zero or infinity? So in fact, in one-dimensional quantum mechanics, there is this nice theorem due to Gelfand and Yablum. You can find a nice discussion of this in this paper if you're interested in learning more. But what it does is it relates this eigenvalue problem. So I had this operator on xn equals lambda n xn, where recall that xn was defined to vanish at the endpoints of the classical path. That was at plus minus t over 2. And this theorem tells you that the solution to this problem of finding these determinants is equivalent to finding the solution to this initial value problem. So I have the same operator, negative dt squared plus v double prime x, acting on some function, we'll call it phi, where the initial conditions are that phi at negative t over 2 is 0 and d tau phi at negative t over 2 is 1. And I just find the solution to this initial value problem and evaluate it when I'm at the other endpoint, when big phi is t over 2. And this works for any potential you can imagine. So as long as this is finite, then you know that this determinant is finite. If you look at the harmonic oscillator example in this paper, we don't have to go through this in detail, but in this paper they give a nice discussion of how to evaluate the functional determinant. Yesterday I just kind of quoted the answer, but if I look at this ratio, the ratio is a little bit better defined. It's related to the sinh, which had to do with the exponential, and I could equivalently get this by looking at this ratio of these functions, okay, evaluated at the endpoints. So So that's just a brief aside on how to evaluate these functional determinants to show you that they're real numbers. And while it's hard to do in general, actually this theorem makes it a little bit easier. So before we trudge on and try and apply this reasoning to quantum field theory, are there any questions on what we did yesterday? Okay. Okay, so then without further ado, today we're going to discuss vacuum decay in quantum field theory. So what we want to do is basically find an analogy of the bounce, but now for fields. Okay. So the important thing to note is that we're now looking for field configurations, right? Because when I evaluate the path integral for quantum field theory, this tells me how to connect two different field configurations, okay? Because phi itself is a function of the spatial coordinates. Okay, so that's one thing to note, and we want to find the analog of the bounce. Or that instanton we discussed. And again, we want to imagine that there is some potential. This time, let's explicitly give it another minimum, okay, where we'll label these different positions. This is V now as a function of phi. Phi is our field. We'll label these positions phi f and phi t, where the f stands for false, and the t stands for true. So this is the state of lowest energy, and that's where the system would ultimately like to be. And we want to find some configuration that interpolates between phi f and phi t. So that's going to tell us something like what this bounce did, right? And again, we can go to Euclidean time to define a classical path or a classical field configuration that allows us to connect these two places on this potential. And in direct analogy, we can calculate a width, and now it's a width per unit volume. And this is going to be some prefactor times e to the minus Euclidean action y bar over h bar, where now this action we're going to have to evaluate for a field configuration instead of just a function x of t. Okay, so what are the pieces that we need to stick in here? Effectively, what we're going to do is we're going to take this and turn it into a 1D quantum mechanics problem by assuming a set of symmetries for these field configurations. And then I can directly recycle the result that we had from yesterday. So first, let's write what the Euclidean action for scalar field theory would be. So this is just the integral d tau d3x 1/2 d phi d tau squared plus grad squared grad phi squared
plus v of phi.
Okay, and again, the only change between the Lorentzian action for a scalar field and the Euclidean action for a scalar field is that v is now minus v. So that's the same as before. And what we're going to do is we're going to try and assume, we're going to make a conjecture, which later was verified, but the conjecture is that the configurations we're looking for have O4 symmetry, that is, they have rotational invariance in this Euclidean space. So this is motivated, first of all, by simplicity. Okay, what is the simplest thing I can imagine doing? It's basically something with spherical symmetry. Okay, but it turns out that you can prove that this is the right thing to do. Okay, so that means that phi is going to be a function of this variable rho alone, where rho is just the radius in Euclidean space. Okay. So with this assumption, we can simplify this action drastically. So with this assumption, the Euclidean action is just going to be given by 2 pi squared times an integral from 0 to infinity of d rho, rho cubed, 1/2 d phi d rho squared plus v of phi. So this is our action, and now we've truncated the problem to a problem in one dimension, and we know how to do that. So now we're basically just going to port everything that we learned from yesterday over to this problem, and see what we get. Okay, so step one, remember, is to find the classical path and we'll call it phi bar in analogy with x bar. So if from the Euclidean action we can vary that to get the equations of motion for phi, and those are just going to be given by the following. And the type of solution we're looking for, so the boundary conditions that we want to stick in here to define phi bar initial and phi bar final, well, we would like that phi as rho goes to infinity equals phi f, and phi at rho equals 0 is somewhere near phi t. So if we were to draw this in the Euclidean plane, let's say this is tau, and this is one of these x-coordinates, we want some spherically symmetric configuration which near the center is close to phi t, but then as I go far away, approaches phi f. So this, in Euclidean space, indeed looks like a little bubble of phi t that contained in a background of phi f. So this is going to be the type of configuration that we're interested in finding. So we need another boundary condition, which is a boundary condition on the first derivative. And that's easy because from the friction term, so you can see that this is an equation of motion for phi that has a source of friction in addition to the gradient of the potential. So from this 3 over rho d phi d rho term, it follows that as rho goes to 0, you must have d phi d rho going to 0 as well, right? Because otherwise, I'd get a divergent term in the equation of motion. And then we wouldn't be able to solve this. So that's enough. We have a set of initial conditions, and we have an equation of motion. And why don't we just explicitly put the bar on here, because we're really solving for this classical path. So this, if we look at our potential, but flip it upside down, so if we plot minus V versus phi, here again we've got phi F, and here phi T. We want to figure out how to send a particle down this hill such that at t equals infinity, it ends up at the top of the other side. So that came from this boundary condition here. Phi bar as rho goes to infinity has to be at phi f. And we can do that, or at least we can show that there must be a solution using this argument due to Coleman having to do with the undershoot and overshoot. So if we can find a solution that would overshoot this point, and we can find a solution that would undershoot this point, then we know there has to be a real solution somewhere in between. So the first one you can undershoot by just starting too low. So if we sketch this again, if I start the ball here, then it's just going to roll up. Remember, there's friction, so the energy of this particle is actually decreasing in time. So it's just never, ever going to have enough energy to make it up to phi f. And we can overshoot by starting very close to phi t. So in this case, if I sit arbitrarily close to phi t, I'll just stay there forever. If I put the field exactly at phi t, it's at a point of unstable equilibrium, but it's just going to sit there forever, right? And as rho increases, that friction term decreases in importance, okay? So by sitting near the top for long enough, the friction dies out before you move. And then now energy is basically conserved, and I'll just fly right over this hill because I started an energy higher than phi f. Is that clear? Okay, I'll take that as a yes. So we have the solution. If we start too low, we overshoot. We start too high, we start too low, we undershoot. We start too high, we overshoot. And that means that somewhere in between, we'll call that position phi star. There has to be some initial position that I can start at, which is just right, and gets me exactly to phi f as rho goes to infinity. So this is an existence proof of such solutions. In general, you have to numerically compute these solutions, implementing an algorithm that's basically what I just said. First you look for solutions that overshoot, then you look for solutions that undershoot, and kind of like root finding, you zero in on just the right initial condition. So the solution, if we just plot it, is going to look something like this. Let's say that this is, this is a plot of phi versus rho, I have some solution that starts at phi star, and then approaches phi f as rho goes to infinity. So I'm going to vary things until I find just the solution. If I ended up overshooting, what this would look like is something like that. I just run off to infinity. If I undershot, I'd roll back, and this is the solution exactly in between that overshoot and that undershoot. And now that we have phi bar, of course, the thing to do is to compute the Euclidean action evaluated at phi bar and the fluctuations around that. Okay. And so we already have a prescription for doing that. We did that yesterday. The only difference for today is that there are, in fact, four zero modes. Everything else is the same, but now there's four zero modes. The reason is that I can take this instanton and I can center it anywhere in Euclidean space. Okay. So again, I do this sum over all the possible positions, and that gives me the zero mode, but now I've got four zero modes because there's four dimensions in Euclidean space. Yeah? The other difference is that this is spherically symmetric, so I don't have the other side of the bounce like we had in one dimensions. Okay. So the bounce itself is just something that goes from rho equals zero to rho equals infinity. And the answer, just to quote the answer, is just like we had the other day, except for now, since we're talking about field theory, this is the width per unit volume. Okay, the width per unit volume is given by this Euclidean action evaluated at phi bar over 2 pi h bar, and now it's squared. So I get a power. I get a Euclidean action over 2 pi h bar to the 1/2 to the fourth power. For every zero mode, I just raise that square root to the appropriate power. And again, I've got this ratio of functional determinants. So I've got negative d rho v double prime evaluated at phi bar f divided by the functional determinant with all the zero modes removed, just like yesterday, v double prime phi bar to the 1/2 power. I get an h bar, and then I get an e to the minus Euclidean action phi bar over h bar.
Can you say again why did you get square?
So the square comes because I need to, for each zero mode, so for each zero mode, you multiply by SE evaluated at phi bar over 2 pi h bar to the 1/2. So in the path integral, we have now an expansion coefficient for each direction. And by doing the same thing we did yesterday, you get a factor of that to the 1/2 for each zero.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Can you say again how you saw that there were four of them?
So you get four because I need to do this sum over all of the possible field configurations that I can imagine. So before, remember, we had this train of field configurations. And by summing them up, we got this t to the n over n factorial. Yeah. Now we have these solutions which are living in four-dimensional Euclidean space. So I actually have imagine a gas of these field configurations, and I need to sum up all of the possible ways of making a guess of these field configurations. And so I have translational invariants in each of the four Euclidean directions that I need to sum over. And that gives me this to the power 4. Okay, so this has dimensions of mass to the fourth power. And that's basically all coming from this determinant. And we can sort of, I guess the other thing I should mention is that just like before, it's important that there's one negative mode. And you can see that using the same arguments that we had before. These translationally invariant modes are just the derivative of phi bar with respect to rho. And so you're going to get solutions that have a node. And you're looking for a nodeless solution. That's going to be the one that has the zero, the negative mode. Okay, we can take this and we can estimate it. So this has to be something of order mass to the fourth power, and at least for the harmonic oscillator example, the dimensions or the sort of magnitude of the determinant was set by the mass of the harmonic oscillator. So we might imagine that the same is true here. In fact, that's borne out by some more careful arguments. So we can estimate this as V double prime squared evaluated at the false vacuum, say, e to the minus Euclidean action at phi bar over h bar. So this is an order of magnitude estimate for this ratio of functional determinants. It's basically related to the mass, some characterization of the mass scale involved in the problem. Okay, so this is a calculation of the, remember, correction to the ground state energy effectively. So this is the imaginary correction to the ground state energy of this field theory. And in the case of a particle, it was pretty clear what the physical interpretation was. So, you know, I have this unstable well, and I start here, and then at some time later, I find the particle somewhere else. And the same is borne out here. I have some empty vacuum, and then at some later time, if I make an observation, there's some probability that I see this field configuration now appear. So the interpretation is that this configuration appears with probability set by gamma over volume. And so if I look at Euclidean space, this is again, say, tau. And one of these dimensions, I have this field configuration, which is a function of rho, where in the center I'm basically at phi t, and far away I'm in phi f. And what I can do is I can look at tau equals zero, slice this, and then go back to real time t. So that at t equals 0, I have this field configuration, which in the center looks like phi t. But now it's going to get some dynamics. It's not going to be static anymore. So let's see where that comes from. Well, there's a physical reason you might expect this to not be static, which is that in phi t, I have a state with lower energy. So I've just put this configuration into real space that's filled with some stuff that has lower energy density. And because it has lower energy density, it's going to want to expand. So here, if instead I looked at a tx plot, let's look at a like xy plot. So I'm sitting here, I make this spherical bubble, and because it has lower energy, it's going to want to expand. Simple as that. And we can see this from a little bit of a more mathematical perspective. Because in fact, this field configuration tells us about the entire dynamics. It specifies the full solution in real time as well as imaginary time. So let's see how that works. So remember, phi was a function of rho, which is a function of square root tau squared plus x squared. And we assumed that this configuration had this four-dimensional rotational invariance. And that means the metric was this. That's just the metric of a four-sphere. And if we just write that out, so this is d rho squared plus rho squared. I've got angles. I'll call them theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. Okay, so that's the metric on our four-sphere. This is the metric of flat Euclidean space written in spherical coordinates. So nothing deeper than that. And if we look at this metric and we take theta 1 goes to I theta 1 plus I pi over 2. This is basically going to define the right analytic continuation, that is the right way to take time to I time. And if I do this, then basically I get, so this is this Euclidean metric, I get a Lorentzian metric that looks something like negative rho squared d theta 1 squared plus d rho, d rho squared plus rho squared times the metric on a two-sphere. So when I stick theta 1 goes to I theta 1 plus I pi over 2, then that takes this. It gives it a negative sign because I've got I theta 1, I d theta 1 squared. So I get a negative sign from the I squared. I've got my rho squared here. And then I'm going to get, here in fact, rho squared sinh theta 1 squared d omega 2 squared. And this, you will recognize as Rindler space. So this is a metric we saw in the second class, I believe. This is the metric seen by an observer undergoing constant acceleration. We could have gotten this, just a little side box. So if we had ds squared is the regular Minkowski metric, then we can get Rindler space by identifying t is rho sinh theta 1, and r is rho cosh theta 1. And so you can see in here, by taking theta 1 goes to I theta 1 plus I pi over 2, this is like taking t goes to I tau. So that's where the connection is made. So let's use another piece of technology that that you guys have learned, which is Penrose diagram. So if I draw the Penrose diagram for flat space, recall that Rindler space fills this part. So this left line is r equals 0. This is r equals infinity. And t equals infinity, this is r equals infinity. And t goes to minus infinity, this line here. Okay. And Rindler space fills this wedge, where the surfaces of constant space-like coordinate rho look something like this. And the instanton tells me phi bar as a function of rho. And what that means is that if I know the field configuration on this slice t equals 0, I know the field configuration, I know the field configuration everywhere. So I know the field configuration at every slice of constant rho, where rho equals 0 is this light cone, and phi bar is equal to this very special value phi star that I needed to assume to get a solution. And out here, phi bar is equal to phi f. So you'll recall that the Penrose diagram, each point on the Penrose diagram is just a sphere. So if I look at these solutions, I have, for each value of constant field, a sphere that is undergoing constant acceleration. So this looks like a field configuration that is spherically symmetric and expands with constant acceleration. That all comes from the instanton. It just came from making this identification of how to go from Euclidean time to Lorentzian time. So the instanton itself specifies the field configuration everywhere in Rindler space. So that's pretty great. Not only did we get the decay rate for the vacuum from the instanton, we actually got the full configuration of the field for all time by solving for the instanton. So it tells us not only the decay rate, but it tells us what happens after you form this configuration. That's pretty cool. So there's still this part of the space-time, right? So I don't know what happens inside of this wedge. But we can at least say what kind of analytic continuation we need to get it. So if we instead of doing what we did above, we take rho to I rho, and theta 1 goes to I theta 1, then I'll get a metric that looks like this. And you know, that should actually be a cosh. Apologize for that. So we get a metric that looks like this, which you'll recognize as just an open FRW universe, where the scale factor is just rho. So this looks like Robertson-Walker metric with k equals minus 1 when you write it in spherical symmetry. This is also known as the Milne patch. And it describes the space-time in this wedge, the part that the instanton didn't tell me about. So here I have at rho equals 0, phi equals phi star. And the constant time surfaces, the constant rho surfaces, look something like this. And so really what's happening in here is that I'm working with this Lorentzian potential. I had this value phi star. And after I do this analytic continuation, then phi is just going to roll down from phi star. So on these surfaces of constant time, I have evolution in an open universe of phi down to phi t. So that up here, eventually, I end up with phi bar equals phi t, okay, at future infinity in this part of Minkowski space.
Sorry, what did you have then on the diagonal rho equals 0, phi bar equals?
Phi star. Phi star was this position we had to start at to get the instanton solution. And furthermore, you'll note that theta 1, this coordinate theta 1, well, theta 1 is just the distance along any constant rho surface from the center of the bubble. Theta 1 can go between 0 and infinity. So inside of this bubble, you fit an infinite open universe. It's really infinite. Okay, so by forming this bubble, you've in fact given birth to this infinite open Robertson-Walker universe inside here. Okay. So that's the full solution. You now have everything you need to compute the decay rate of a vacuum in quantum field theory and discuss what happens afterwards. Okay, you form this bubble-like configuration that then expands with constant acceleration. And there's a particularly simple limit that one can take, known as the thin wall limit, which allows you to express a lot of these formulas analytically. So I want to discuss that in the last 15 minutes of the class. So let's say I had a potential, and I'll draw the Euclidean version, where these two wells at phi f and phi t are nearly degenerate. So v at phi f is approximately equal to v at phi t. So now I'm in a situation where if I start at phi t immediately, I don't wait very long, I roll down, I'm always going to undershoot because the energy I have is approximately equal to the energy of the false vacuum and I've got friction. So if I just let myself go fairly far away from phi t, I'm going to end up undershooting. And the only way to prevent undershooting is to put myself very close to phi t so that I can sit there and wait out the friction, because the friction is decreasing like 3 over rho. So we need to put phi star approximately equal to phi t to get a solution. And in this case, if we were to plot what that actual solution looks like, it would sit near phi t for a fairly long time, and then it would make the transition to phi f. So there's this window over which the field makes the transition, but it's essentially instantaneous compared to the time it spends sitting near phi t. So the transition time is short compared to the loitering time near phi t. And this, if we were to draw it, right, would look like in Euclidean space. Some very thin annulus, some very thin shell in which I make the transition. Everywhere inside that shell, I'm basically at phi t, and everywhere outside, I'm basically at phi f. So that's what this solution would look like in Euclidean space. And this region, it's a thin shell, so it should have associated with it a tension, right? I could imagine just integrating over the field configuration in this vicinity and defining a tension. And that tension can be written as an integral from phi f to phi t over this quantity v plus, which takes a second to explain. So I have this potential. It's asymmetric, right? So it has phi f, v at phi f bigger than v at phi t. But I can deform this so that it is symmetric. If I had a potential v of phi that was, say, phi squared minus m squared squared plus epsilon phi, this thing is a symmetric double well where the wells are located at plus minus m. And this is the term that breaks the symmetry. So v plus would just be the first part. Okay, we get rid of the symmetry breaking term. So this defines the tension. That's fairly intuitive. This is something that has mass dimension 2. So this characterizes the energy density in the field configuration locally. And then we integrate over phi. So with this tension, and the vacuum energy difference between the true and false vacuum, we can calculate all of the quantities we want. Okay, so there's the critical radius, which basically is the position in rho that I make this leap from one side to the other, which one can derive to be 3 sigma, that's the tension, over the potential evaluated at the false vacuum minus the potential evaluated at the true vacuum. So in real space, when the bubble forms, the bubble forms with radius r naught, and then it starts to grow. There's also the Euclidean action, which you can compute in this limit, SE of phi bar, to be the following. 27 pi squared sigma to the fourth power over the difference between the false and true vacuum energies cubed times 2. So you can find the derivation of the critical radius and the Euclidean action in the paper by Coleman. I believe this is also in the uses of instantons reference that I gave you on the syllabus. But this is the answer. And again, it's derived using all the same tools that we've used so far. So basically, I look for a solution. I had that Euclidean action, which has subsequently been erased. And I put that in, and I evaluate it. And this is what comes out. OK, so in the last minutes, let's do an example to just get a feel for how this works, okay, for a real potential. So let's assume we have a potential V of phi, which is some mass scale to the fourth power, we'll call it mu, times phi over m squared minus 1 squared. Plus epsilon phi over m, again, times mu to the fourth power. We'll put a 2 here. So if we plot this, we have some potential v of phi that looks like this, where the minima are located at plus and minus m. Mu to the fourth power basically tells us the height of this potential barrier. So we have a width, which is set by m, and we have a height that's set by mu. Okay, and epsilon tells us how degenerate these wells are. Okay, so by tuning epsilon, I break the symmetry in here. And on each side, I'll basically lower the well on the right by epsilon mu to the fourth. And on the left, I'll raise it by epsilon mu to the fourth. OK, so that's our model. So first, we calculate sigma. So sigma is the integral from negative m to m times the square root of 2 v plus, where v plus is just defined by getting rid of this epsilon term. So I have square root 2, and then I've got a mu squared, and then I've got this guy where I've just removed the square because I took the square root d phi. And this integral, of course, is easily evaluable. It's just a polynomial. And the answer you'll get is 4 square root 2 over 3 times m times mu squared. So this is the value of the tension. And vf minus vt is just epsilon mu to the fourth power. Now I can take these and I can calculate the initial radius and the Euclidean action for the bubble that will form. So the critical radius is just going to be 4 square root 2 m over epsilon mu squared. So we can look at this and get a feel for what makes a bigger or a smaller bubble. You get a bigger bubble when the wells are more degenerate, that is, epsilon is small, or when you have a high barrier, that is, mu squared is big, or when you have a wide potential, excuse me. Those all give you a big initial radius. We can also evaluate the Euclidean action. If you stick this in, it's given by 512 pi squared over 3 mu times r naught to the fourth power, okay, where r naught is defined here. And you'll recall that the width per unit volume is given by the prefactor times e to the minus s over h bar. So when s is big, the decay is highly suppressed. Okay, and s is big when you have big bubbles or when you have high barriers. Okay? So this is more or less intuitive. You'd expect it to be harder to tunnel through a barrier that is both tall and wide. And so you get a corresponding suppression in this value for the Euclidean action.
Okay.
So one last thing I'll mention real briefly. That's a concrete example. You can look at the energy of this configuration. So I have this bubble with some tension sigma. It's Vt inside, Vf outside. And you can guess the equation for the total energy of this system. So this is the surface area of the bubble times the tension, okay? And then because this thing is moving, I need to divide by a Lorentz factor, right? Because it's going to get kinetic energy, and I need to have a relativistic characterization of that kinetic energy. And then I've got a volume energy. So I've got 4 pi over 3 r cubed vf minus vt, where basically I've chosen a convenient zero for the energy, and that's why I get this difference. And the critical bubble corresponds to the solution where the energy is zero. So if I stick E equals zero, and I assume that at the initial time, the time when this bubble formed, R dot is zero, then it follows from this equation that R naught must be 3 sigma over Vf minus Vt, which is what we got up here. So this is another way of seeing how this comes out. We're basically finding the configuration that has the minimum energy. Okay? E equals 0 is as low as you can go. If it was negative, we'd be in trouble. And we can see from this equation what happens. Basically, all of the kinetic energy, all of the vacuum energy that I liberate by making a bubble bigger goes into accelerating the wall. So those are the only two things in this equation. I can solve for R dot from this equation. Find a differential equation for R of t, and what we'll find is that is just equal to t squared plus r naught squared. So that in a time of order r naught inverse, the wall is basically moving at the speed of light. And the initial radius of these bubbles is typically a microscopic quantity. Okay, so I have to wait, you know, like a femtosecond before one of these bubbles approaches the speed of light. So if this were to happen somewhere in the observable universe, it'd be kind of a bummer because you wouldn't even see it coming. This would form. It would expand almost immediately at the speed of light. And so any signal, any warning that anyone could send out would reach you, you know, like a femtosecond before the wall slams into you. And it would hurt because it has tension, right? So this is something that has an enormous amount of kinetic energy. So if this were to happen, you know, we would just be completely obliterated. It would be like being hit by something that has energy density of order, you know, like gut scale energy density on the wall moving at nearly the speed of light. So that would be kind of a bummer. Okay, so that's basically what I had for you today. So you learned how to compute the decay rate of the vacuum. You learned how to interpret the instanton as a solution that, after the bubble forms, grows with constant acceleration. Right? All that information came from the same computation of the decay rate. And then there's this nice approximation you can make, the thin wall approximation, which allows you to write some of these formulas analytically. We did a particular example, and looking at the energy of this configuration is another way of understanding its dynamics. So that's a basic summary of what we did today. So before we go, are there any questions? Okay, so I'm a fan of polls. So how many of you believe we should worry that the universe is going to decay? Show of hands.
Well, we shouldn't worry because it's something which is good.
That's true. It would just happen. It would just happen. Okay, well, tomorrow I'll tell you why you might want to worry about the universe decaying, because when you look at realistic models of particle physics, oftentimes there are false vacua. And in particular, string theory, if it purports to solve the cosmological constant problem by having a positive vacuum energy, is always unstable to decay. So if that is really the way that we get a vacuum energy in our universe, then our universe is going to decay eventually, although I'll show you it's probably a pretty small rate. So see you tomorrow.